Welcome to CSEK News, the only news source in the North truly dedicated to local stories on the ground. CSEK News addresses the diverse needs of the underserved communities between Burns Lake and Haida Gwaii through firsthand stories and in-depth interviews. CSEK News funding is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially support campus and community radio stations in Canada, as well as the Government of Canada. We are your hosts, Pam Hassan and Dan Messick, and we are on the dial at 93.9 FM, Smithers Community Radio. Our call letters are CSEK, and we are broadcasting from the unceded Gitindam territory, home of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. Follow CSEK News online at smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook or Instagram at Smithers Community Radio.
Today on CSEK News, in advance of National Indigenous Peoples Day, we take a look at some of the best Indigenous stories we've covered across Northwest BC. National Indigenous Peoples Day recognizes and celebrates the history, heritage, resilience, and diversity of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples across Canada. Stories that are not only linked to people and community, but also to the land and water. Today, we'll hear stories about the importance of basketball at the 63rd All-Native Basketball Tournament in Prince Rupert earlier this year, the premier sporting event of the year for Indigenous basketball teams from across the province and beyond. We'll also hear what it sounds like to be on the front lines of the fight for Indigenous rights during the years-long conflict between the Wet'suwet'en Nation and the Coastal GasLink Pipeline Project, following Chief Namox's appearance at the RBC AGM earlier this year, one of the major backers of the pipeline project. Pam will also take us through Morgan Burden's story on the repatriation of a Nisga totem pole and how the community is celebrating its return, but also facing the reality that more missing cultural artifacts that were stolen many years ago are still out there somewhere in the world. On Haida Gwaii, Pam covers the renaming of a municipality on the northern archipelago to its traditional name, Dodgin Geats, and why using Haida names to describe Haida places is a big deal. Happy National Indigenous Peoples Day. Stay with us.
Today, as an acknowledgement of Indigenous Peoples Day in Canada, I want to share two stories from this past year that are Indigenous created, led, or feature only Indigenous voices. The first story is by CFNR journalist and CSEK community reporter Morgan Budden. Morgan worked on this story about the repatriation of a Nisga memorial pole, and I thought that this was a really strong story. This was one of Morgan's earliest news stories that she did as part of the local journalism initiative out of Terrace, and while this was an important story that I myself tried to cover, when Morgan was granted the interview, I felt like the pieces just all came together.
Hello, I'm Morgan Budden from CFNR, and I'm here to bring you a special episode of municipal election coverage for CSEK News Smithers Community Radio, from the traditional unceded territory of the Tsimshian people. With this piece, CSEK News wanted to focus on what the relationship between municipal governments and the Indigenous populations that they are supposed to represent looks like currently, what it could look like, and what a few potential Terrace City Council candidates hope to do about it. During each interview, I noticed two topics that kept coming up in answers: communication and education. It seems that in order to further truth and reconciliation on a municipal level, there needs to be more open communication between Indigenous communities and the municipalities that they surround. Cultural education is something that more and more people seem to be wanting to participate in recently, but how does that translate to potential city officials? I spoke with three council candidates on this topic, and the first person is Dave Gordon, who is an incumbent seeking re-election and has been outspoken about Indigenous representation in the past, specifically through art.
Well, I'm running for city council. This might be my first four-year term. I came in on a by-election in June last year, so I've been 14 months in. It's been a real learning process for me to see how local government actually works, what we can do, what we can't do. In Terrace, it's really governed by what we can afford to do, because we don't really have the tax base to do the things that we want to do. We're stuck doing the things we have to do. There are some things that I want to make some progress on, new areas. Reconciliation's a key part of that. So I've been involved in, as you know, putting a lot of murals up in town, project managing that, helping the artists fill in the empty spots where they tell me to paint, which is lots of fun. And I think in some respects, it's really transformed how people look at our town. We get seen as a town that embraces the arts. And, you know, before we started doing the murals, the presence of First Nations culture as shown in was really missing. You know, we've got a pole in front of the RCMP station, friendship pole from Kitsum Kalem. We got a couple of poles up at the arena, one in front of the mall. And, you know, I struggle after that to think where people can look around in town and say, that's my culture. I belong here. So that was a key goal for that. And I want to continue on with that. It's difficult in city council to paint murals on private walls. So I'll be doing that on my own time. But I also look around town and I struggle to see one word of smell yaks anywhere in town written down. And that's, you know, you have to start with the simple wins first and build relationships and learn how to do some of this stuff. And the city's kind of slow at this, but they're trying with the capacity, and I'm going to keep pushing on that. You know, I see the stop sign at Kitsum Kalem, Gialoo. It's not hard to do that sort of stuff. And everybody knows what a red octagonal sign means. Like, we can do that here as well. We need smell yaks on our welcome to terrace signs. You know, we need it on some of our street signs. That's easy work to do. We just have to push a little harder to get that done. And, you know, as you start building some of those relationships and recognizing the First Nations people here as a key part of our community and accepting them and making sure they feel accepted in the community, it makes for a much stronger community. We've got some really strong challenges in this community. We need to work at those things together.
Have you ever had conversations with the First Nations community about what sort of changes they'd like to see in the town to take into consideration their desires more when it comes to decision making?
I have to say I haven't done a lot of that at that level. You know, I see the mayor and our chief officer, Chris Boland, doing that work, and I'm following and watching the protocol of local government to try and figure out how that works and where I fit in. You know, I've certainly sat with folks like CJ Nabass, who's a fellow counselor on Kitsilis, and chatted with him. We need to do more of that. But learning how governments speak to each other is an area that I'm still learning about. And it's a little different than how community speaks to each other. It doesn't necessarily need to be. And I sometimes sense a bit of caution, or I'm reluctant to use the word fear, but caution of misstep amongst local government, worried that they're going to talk to the wrong person or do the wrong thing. And I think we just have to talk more and try things. And if we make a mistake, people will tell us and we'll move on. We're all human. Everybody makes mistakes, but we won't make progress unless we chat a little bit more. I'm sitting at the table with Kitsilis and Kitsum Kalem on treaty, and we've been meeting by Zoom. Just not a great way to build relationships. I'm really looking forward to the days when we all sit in a room together. Chief Roberts was talking about that at the last meeting, that we just need to get in the same room. Things move along a lot faster. Great to see both of those nations close to the finish line. It's a slow, arduous process that requires us to talk about punctuation and grammar a lot so that there's no misunderstanding, and I'm learning a lot. But I think our, you know, in terms of government to government, community to community, kind of glad most of the pandemic measures are behind us and we can get back together and talk in the same room.
Speaking of treaty, with negotiations going on between the sort of sandwiching communities of Terrace, do you think that there's any possibility that those agreements could change the way council runs a little bit, you know, considering bylaws, and do they go hand in hand?
Well, we talk a lot already. The city, you know, when we put forward our Safe Streets bylaw, for instance, we did a lot of discussion with neighboring communities to make sure that, you know, the wishes and the desires of the bylaw met, you know, were consistent with the desires in our neighboring communities. So I think there's some good discussions there. I think it'll grow, especially at once the treaty is signed, you know, and the formality is there. I think there's talks now about Kitsum Kalem and Kitsilis sitting formally on the regional district and having seats there. It's sort of surprised to me. It's like, what do you mean they're not here? They should have been here a long time ago. So I don't know where that's at, but I believe that's underway. You know, I think we'll be a lot stronger as a community when we build those liaisons, and I think the treaty process will help.
Do you think adopting maybe some traditional ways of governance could help?
Oh, I think so, certainly. You know, First Nations governance and communication is quite different than the colonial way that we govern our town. I don't know how you would fit that in process-wise or what we're governed by legislation. I'm not an expert in that regard. But we as politicians need to turn up to those community events and hear that part. just as much as we hope they'll turn up and listen to us. It's an awkward way to do business formally, but there's other ways that we can get to know each other and understand their concerns and make the change the community would like to see.
Making changes in the community is always great and one of the jobs of council. But what about making changes within council? You know, internal changes to the way that people react to First Nations issues. Some people can kind of get uncomfortable with those sorts of discussions. What is it like? Have you had to navigate that sort of dynamic, having to have those conversations with fellow councillors?
Well, I'm having it right now because we had a council meeting that I'm sure people know about and heard about on Monday with folks that self-describes themselves as warriors coming to defend the interests of people in town. You know, they're really passionate and it's forced a little bit more discussion. We had three police cars turn up for that event for one guy who was loud but very passionate and absolutely not criminal. And we had another person at the end of the meeting who talked about shooting people that came on his property, and no cars, police cars turned up for him. So people look at that and go, well, it's not fair. This is the powerful protecting the powerful. And we have to make sure that that's not the case, and that we have to find a venue for listening to the concerns in the community. But certainly the ability for us as leaders in the community to go and talk to those folks and understand their issues, that's the work I'm trying to do right now.
I then spoke with Sarah Zimmerman. She is running for council for the first time, and a large part of her platform focuses on truth and reconciliation. Zimmerman is actually one of four council candidates who mentioned Indigenous representation and truth and reconciliation in their platform.
My name's Sarah Zimmerman. I've lived in Terrace for 22 years. I moved here for 6 months and never left. And my background in the community is really professionally. I was a reporter for 7 years at the local newspaper. And then I switched paths into communications and public relations. And I've worked in a variety of capacities, from owning my own business, which is what I do now, to having worked both at the corporate level and in public sector. So through post-secondary education. And in that time, in the 22 years, not only have I been able to work with a lot of different organizations in our community, but I'm a bit of a volunteeraholic, so I've spent a lot of time volunteering my time and efforts to support things like sporting events and arts and economic development initiatives. So that's kind of me in a nutshell.
How would you take into consideration the cultural and traditional beliefs of Indigenous communities into your decision making?
That's a great question. I mean, I'm not Indigenous, so I don't know all the cultural and traditional beliefs that Indigenous people have. And, you know, the city of Terrace services more than just the Tsimshian Nation. We've got residents who are Haisla, Haida, Niska. We've got residents that come from other parts of Canada that live here that have a varied background when it comes to their indigeneity. And so I think that we need to look to the people on whose territory that we operate and find out first what's appropriate for council to do. I would hate to be a settler making a decision around anything cultural that I don't know about, or I haven't engaged people who do know about. So I'm hesitant to say how I would do that, because I think it starts with really asking the question to the folks that know best, and making sure that we have a way and a mechanism of reaching out to both Kitsilis and Kitsimkalim around what are the appropriate things for us to do. I think, you know, things like land acknowledgements are critical. They're an important part of any meeting that we have. You know, I think making those relationships is really important before you try to implement somebody else's cultural practices. I think more importantly is, you know, making sure that we are in a position where we can have that kind of outreach and start that dialogue. I think there's room for improvement there. And I hope that I could play a role in helping guide that process, and knowing that we can reach out to folks and ask for guidance, those kinds of issues.
Are there any specific issues that affect Indigenous communities that you would want to focus on?
Everything. Everything we've talked about affects Indigenous communities as much as they affect other people in our community. I mean, our neighbors are Kitsum Kalum and Kitsilis. Terrace is located on the traditional territory of Tsimshian people. It's unceded. I don't think that the city of Terrace can look at any decision-making without also considering an Indigenous lens to it, because we're neighbors, we're here. You know, we have to work together and find a better way to work together moving forward. I think that the path to reconciliation is really complex, and it's going to take baby steps to get there and a willingness to get there. And I think it starts with education. We look at things like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's calls to action, and they're, you know, there's about 12 of them that pertain to municipalities. And I think if we break those down one by one, there's some very actionable items that can happen in municipalities that don't require a lot of money and don't require a lot of prep. It's things that can be actioned relatively easily. And then there's other kind of policy items. There's other, you know, ways of moving forward, strategic planning from how to enact the recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, so that it can be measurable and it can be, you know, a plan that people can see and recognize what efforts the city has been taken and where the city needs to go. So I think we're kind of really at the beginning of that. And I don't know all the mechanisms of how to implement that. I mean, really, I wish I had a magic wand and I could see the future, but I think it starts with education, and it starts with coming from a place of really wanting to develop relationships with especially our two neighbors on either side of our community, and genuinely showing up to learn more and to ask questions and to be able to stumble along the way as we get there together.
How would you handle any sort of discussion, internal discussion in council when it comes to handling Indigenous issues?
Well, I think with any topic, particularly when we're talking about things that affect our neighbors and the people in our community and our constituents, I come to the table with a pretty confident ability to speak my mind. And I also come with the ability to look at things from kind of a strategic lens in terms of wanting to always learn more and research more. You know, a good council is going to have diverse views. A good council is going to bring to the table the perspectives of a wide range of our constituents. And so I hope that we'll be able to have healthy conversations where we can be respectful with one another and really encourage one another to show up and do what's best for our community, and keep in mind, you know, that we are living on unceded territory and we need to move forward together. So I know that doesn't say how I would show up for issues. I think every issue is case by case. You know, are we talking about cultural training for council members or for staff? That's something I would advocate for. It's right there in the TRC's recommendations. And I've experienced that through working in post-secondary, where when we start to look at UNDRIP and we start to look at the TRC recommendations and really think about how as institutions we can implement those, I think that you can start taking baby steps, and you can also recognize things that maybe have already been done. So I look at things like on National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, we got to see the poll come up that recognizes survivors at Cromoty Friendship Center. And that was a really powerful experience for our community to come together. And so I think, you know, council needs to be at those kinds of events so that we can experience the importance of that and learn more about the cultural practices that were stolen from people for generations, to be present to witness the coming back of those cultural practices is really important for us to understand and share in. And it's just one starting point of being there.
This next piece is a longer piece that features the voices of members of an organization called SHIP, which stands for Skidigit Haida Immersion Program. In recent years, the Geographical Names Board of Canada has worked with Indigenous groups to restore traditional place names to reflect the culture of the original inhabitants of the territory. Some names of European origin have been replaced by traditional Indigenous names, and some unnamed physical features and populated places have been given names in Indigenous languages. Each jurisdiction's approach is different, reflecting its particular geography, history, and circumstances. This long-term work is still evolving as a means of representing the coexistence of all the cultures that have built our past and our present history. This news piece is about restoring the traditional name of Dajin Gids to the once named village of Queen Charlotte. This was a very lengthy process, and the change officially happened on June 6th of last year. Here's the members of SHIP explaining the history and importance of using Haida words to describe Haida places.
When I took training in 1970, there was people from all over the province and many, all the coastal nations understood each other.
This is Gwaganad, or Diane Brown. She is a cultural and language holder of the Eagle Clan and the youngest of only 19 fluent speakers of her ancestral language of Haida Keel.
And then all the interior natives, they understood each other. And I was the only Haida, of course, at the class, but, you know, I couldn't understand anything they said. They couldn't understand my language. It's just like, you know, I don't know how the heck the British would feel if we wanted to call it Gwaisting. Let's change England to Gwaisting because there's two islands there. You know, that would they'd start a world war or something, I'll bet you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you turn it around and trying to call some of their precious places, I mean, I'm sure it had another name a long time ago, but let's call England Gwaisting. See how that feels. It just helps. It helps us, brings us, I don't know how to explain it, but you become closer to your ancestors with the ancestral names. It was wonderful reclaiming the down south names. How I know some non-Haida people have difficulty in accepting and understanding that we communicate with our ancestors as yet. And one of the elders said one day, what's going to happen if we lose our language? Who's going to speak to the ancestors? That one really shook me up. When we were reclaiming the names, it was very powerful. And most of the people that reclaimed the names on that trip, the elders, they're gone now. We did it just in the right time, because if we were to do that today, I don't think we could get a lot of them. Because, for example, Nanking Iuans, we would be stuck on a bay. In Nanking Iuans, one time we went down for the night, and he got up in the morning and he had the answer. He dreamt about it. Dur on that journey, Yungwa Atogad.
Anga.
Yes. And Gaji Awa was.
I was supposed to go too, but I wasn't well.
I don't know who all that's in SHIP today that were on that journey, but.
Lee Swan?
Yeah, he's not here today, though, darn.
No, not today, unfortunately.
I was just trying to grasp the amazing feeling that we got on that journey as we reclaimed them. It was powerful. It was empowering. You know, it was, I felt closer to our ancestors. Many things happened on that journey.
From this meeting and discussion, I gathered two pieces of information that I didn't expect. Firstly, that this isn't just about a name. It's about the Haida people whose way of life and language were nearly extinguished by the introduction of European settlers. And that without their language, the Haida lose the ability to communicate with their ancestors. Secondly, documenting Haida Keel is almost more like a biology lesson than a lesson in semantics. When I asked, what does Dajin Gids mean, or translate to, the answer was deeper than I expected. But that's something unique about the Haida dialects. Of the more than 60 indigenous languages spoken in Canada, Haida is unlike any other. It's a language isolate,
meaning it has no other language relatives, like French has with Spanish and Italian, for example. The Haida language consists of three main dialects: Alaskan, Haidkill, Masset, Haidkill, and Skidigit, Haidakill. While a Haidakill speaker and Haidkill speaker can mostly understand one another, the three varieties themselves are aggregations of many more that were whispered out of existence with the decimation of the Haida populations as the northwest coast of North America in the 19th and 20th centuries. This is an excerpt from a fantastic article called Saving Language at the Edge of the World by Jensen Edwards that was published in May of 2018. The elders at SHIP wrestle with fragments of upwards of 19 dialects in order to come to a consensus on any given translation. When no one solution can be settled on, they write down and record all of their options. Haida words can also be made by combining sounds that indicate concepts, including whether they are horizontal or vertical things, made of wood or made of stone. There are very few word-for-word English to Haida translations. More often than not, a simple English word or phrase involves finding the appropriate sentence in Haida. More often than not, an English expression is just an imprecise pronoun, a simple verb, and a temporal observation. But when translated into Haida, it becomes a cultural revelation. But when I spoke to the members of SHIP, they emphasized the impact of name and place using traditional language as a way to recognize Haida life and Haida land.
You know, like Queen Charlotte, that's not the real name of these islands. They had a name long before contact. So did Dajangita's ancient name. Mm-hmm. And then particularly some offensive explorers that did some terrible things were really in a hurry to get them off.
I just feel that reclaiming our history is so important to our Haida people.
This is Crystal.
And this is a form of reconciliation, is to reclaim a part of us again.
How many people speak Haida now?
In terms of fluent speakers, first language speakers, under 10 in Skidigit.
And practicing?
Well, we have 6 first language speakers with us at SHIP.
Less than 10 for sure.
Mm-hmm.
What do you love about speaking Haidakill? And also, where do you feel it in your body when you're speaking fluently with another Haidakill speaker?
Well, for example, this morning, Talgad and I made a little exchange in our language, and I was just reading, someone had quoted me that it's an exact language. You know, when you hear a word, you can see it and feel it. That doesn't happen with English for us. It's just better, much better.
Way better.
Do you find that it's possible to describe the Haida any of the Haida dialects, but do you feel like it's possible to describe Haida language using English words?
Of course, but like I said, it's not exact. Mm-hmm. You can do it and it doesn't come out the same. Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the name change to Dajangkeeds?
It just should be. This is Haida land, and it's the official language of Haida Gwaii. And it's no different than me being 3 years old, 4 years old, learning how to say Queen Charlotte. I can say it perfectly fine today. Those that can't say Dajangkeeds today in Charlotte could take time out of their day, learn how to pronounce it, reach out to somebody that can.
It's hard for them to understand because it's not, they don't have any ownership to it. And for example, we've started calling our children with Haida names legally. It was just in the news last week about some people from Vancouver Island that called their son a name and the government refused to accept it because it didn't fit the slots. And then when we first, for example, we first called our first granddaughter, Tang Renee, there was a big, you know, oh, we can't say that. And when she started school, the teachers were saying, nobody will be able to say it and all that, you know, they just want to throw blocks up. But now people are saying it fine. My two grandsons, the oldest one is Gunchlants, and the next one is Tison. And the same thing, you know, the settlers, they don't care to see that, I guess, or something.
Once the name is changed and Queen Charlotte is given back to the crown and you have now more people saying Dajingits, do you think this now opens the door and people will want to learn, Haida and settlers will want to learn the language and more about where they live?
Oh, of course.
There's a certain amount that, you know, used to attend ship a long time ago. They want to learn, most of them, but then there's a sector that's against it all, no matter what it is. But the Haida language is the language of Haida Gwaii. And we've gone through a lot of work, especially the elders that aren't with us now, renaming all the villages down south, all the villages up north. They all had names. And so we're reclaiming them all. It's certainly helping us move forward. Mm-hmm. And there's a resistance.
What does Dajingits mean?
There's a, like we say, some words mean many things. Mm-hmm. But Dajin is hat. Geets is children or child of the hat. The Geets part too is, it's pretty honorable name or... You see, all children of chiefs are called Geets. So nobody else can be called that. So I think way back in our histories, that's obviously was the child of a chief that they may have named it after. When we were reclaiming names down south, you have to pull into consideration the landscape, how things are shaped, what happened there.
Among you in the program, you know, how much discussion is interpreting a word or how to define it? And do you find that you may visit the place or hold the thing in your hand in order to describe something better?
I don't know. I mean, for example, there's about 30 to 40 names to explain a wave.
Wagonut, can I have a little discussion with you while we're on this?
Sure, don't get it.
To me, Dajingits means being protected by a hat. Dodging Geets. Okay, that's all.
That makes perfect sense.
Well, because I heard that it's like always, it was always windy there, where the village is, where the community hall is.
The hats were extremely important to all our ancestors and to us today, just for what Talgad had said. It protects us from the wind, the rain, the sun.
And just from listening to you talk about Geets being a word that is used by chiefs, you know, it's almost a protection thing. Yes. And that's what made me really believe what my thoughts were, meant something.
Can I say something? It's Ilja Shilai.
Hey, Ilja Shilai.
This is very interesting. I like what I'm hearing from Diane and Betty. And to me, it gives me a feeling, a real good feeling. Growing up here as a Haida person, going to school in Dodge and Geats, it was very difficult. There was lots of racism, and I felt it mostly from the teachers. And for me, when that pole went up in Dodge and Geats, my chest was so wide open, my heart was open, and it made me feel so good. Yes, this is our home, and they're acknowledging it, and they're paying us a respect. And I feel the same way about this name. Okay, so sometimes we weren't welcome up there in our own territory, but now, the people that don't know that that's Haida land, that's our land, it's getting the proper name back. It's paying respect to us. And I think that's so important for us as Haida people to heal some of the hurts and the pains that have gone on in the past. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
That's deadly, dead on.
My name's Peter Hogan, and I'm the chairperson of the All Native Tournament Committee. And we're coming live to you from the Jim Ciccone Civic Center, Russell Gamble Gymnasium. We're up to 100 games, so like we have 55 teams in the tournament, so we played just over 100 games, and we're getting down to the last three games here now. The tournament, once we start, it seems to just roll along, and every year there's a little bit of a surprise on who the power teams are, right? But this year you got Ianch that's playing here right now. They won it last year, but they're up against Heidelberg from Alaska, who's won it many times too. So it's quite a battle going on out there. And for the week, it's been good. We had we're gonna have a different champion in the ladies already, so. You know, it's nice, always nice when you have different champions. Not just about basketball, and a lot of people come here just to renew old acquaintances and whatever, and a lot of them don't even watch much basketball. And then culture at the start, that's a big part of it. People come and watch opening ceremonies, but don't watch basketball either. So it's quite a mix of what we have, and all the craft fair and everything, people coming down just to buy things or to eat native foods or whatever, right? So I think that the biggest thing is that this is the tournament's design, rules and everything to keep it village orientated. So the villages come to represent and to have their fans come. We go way far south, as far as Heshquet on the outside of Vancouver Island. We've got teams from Vancouver, Burnaby, and then Similkameen's come with a couple real good teams. The ladies won it. The men did quite well too. They came in third. So it's that's from the interior. We have Heidelberg Masters down here from Alaska, and they come every year. They've been here for quite a few years now in a row. But new teams, we don't really have many new teams as such. It's the same teams come every year. You just don't know how strong they're going to be when they get here. Some of the players that play in this tournament have definitely played college ball, and one of the players that played for Kekala, Jacob Tom, he played, you know, down in Australia, but he couldn't make it up this year. He's busy coaching a college team, you know, so there's always things that get in the way of why a player can't come, injury or just can't get away from their commitments, right? So, you know, we miss out on losing, watching a nice player play, but, you know, people have jobs too.
There was one, you know, fella you mentioned who I'm going to go speak to later, but, you know, who are some of the notable players that have really shown up this tournament?
Well, I don't leave the office that much. I really don't get the chance to see it. But, you know, I hear from who's playing well. I know in the intermediates, the Jones boys playing for Skinniget, they've been racking up the points. I think one of them had 50 points one game. So those two brothers are definitely being scoring well for Skidigit. And now Skidigit's in the final. They've worked their way up coming through the back door, so it's going to be interesting. They play Rupert tonight. The local team is a club team, so they don't have a village following like Skidigit will have, right? So they'll have fans, but usually the club teams don't have as many fans as the villages do. And then the final tonight, Burnaby, they have no fans here, right? So they're going to be playing in the final here tonight against another good team. So they're a village team. So it'll be the club team versus village team in both intermediates and in the senior. Well, the opening ceremony is getting to be something that the different groups put their name in way ahead of time. And last, you know, we had a choice out of 10 different groups to pick the one that performed this year and the one that's going to perform next year. The Gitsans will be performing next year. This year was Loco Zap, which is Greenville. And, you know, it's a big event, the opening. And then, of course, now we get ready for basketball after that, right? So it's been interesting. It's been good. And it was a real good showing by the Greenville, the Loco Zap group. They were really well received by everybody that watched the opening.
As Peter mentioned, this tournament has been going on since 1960, long enough to establish a long-running Hall of Fame, and the gymnasium where all the championship games are played is named after one of the original lead organizers, Russell Gamble, from that first tournament more than 63 years ago. I spoke with Gamble's granddaughter, Jillian, about his legacy.
Hey, Jillian, tell me, so your grandpa's up on the wall there, and it's quite hard to miss that picture. So tell me a little bit about that, and why is this picture up on the wall?
While he was running this tournament, he was known as the boss.
What was his name?
Russell Gamble. Yeah, and everybody knew him as the boss. Yeah, right up until, like I say, today it's his birthday. Yeah, I know not a lot of people know that, but there's those of us who do. It's very emotional.
You mentioned, you know, other members of your family and your daughter's taking pictures there. You know, what's kind of the sense of pride that you have when you see your grandpa's picture up on the wall?
Just that we know he's here. We no doubt have, we know he's here watching over them. Doesn't matter the outcome, he's here.
As the tournament wound down, it didn't stop the fans from pumping up the energy and shaking the walls of the Russell Gamble Gymnasium. Following the women's final, I chatted with one of the breakout players from the newly minted champs from Smilkameen.
Hello, my name is Jane Montgomery-Wardenberg, and I'm from the Smilkameen, the lower Smilkameen in the Okanagan.
Hey Jade, I guess tell me a little bit about how your tournament has been going. You guys have been crowned the champions of the women's division. So how does that feel to come out of here champions?
It feels really good. It's something we've been working for a really long time, and we've come close a few times now, and so it feels even better. It feels like a dream come true. For
nice,
sure.
Nice. How many All-Native basketball tournaments is this for you now?
Holy, I first started coming to this tournament, watching my newly crowned MVP, Jasmine Montgomery Reed, battle it out on the Bella Bella Heltzik team. And I fell in love with this tournament, and I fell in love with the culture, and the energy you get when you walk into this gym. And from that moment, I wanted to be a part of it. I've always loved this game. It's been my medicine since I was able enough to bounce a little Space Jam basketball, shooting every timeout at my mom and dad's tournaments, and shooting every halftime, and just fell in love with it. And so I started watching Jasmine, and I got to play with all my relations Vancouver basketball team. I'm not sure which year, but that was the first year. And then I got to bring in, it sparked an idea for me after getting to play for a club team, I was really wanting to play for my own nation. And our band is just a little band. It's called Lower Smilkameen Indian Band, and we're the Smilkameen people. And we've been balling together since we were young, and we've played jant together, and we've grown into this family, and I'm related to everybody on this team. They're my cousins, they're my auntie, my mom played on the team last couple years, and I had my sister Sahaya on my team. I got my uncle coaching me, my auntie managing us, and it's a family affair, and I think that's what makes it really important to me. Sure, we have our stuff, and every family does, but it's cool that we work through that, and we rose above, and we finally got that synergy going, and yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, it's been said several times that it's not just basketball tournament, it's so much more than that. There's a cultural aspect, but what you're talking about, there's a family aspect. A lot of people are related to each other, not only on their own teams or their own nations, but, you know, all together. Everybody kind of knows everyone. So how does it feel to come to this tournament? It sounds like you grew up in this tournament over and over again, and it sounds like you're in the family.
Yeah, we are family. And family is everything to me. Family is the most important. And to be able to do this with my family is just the sparkle on top. Yeah.
For years, Chief Namox, one of the high-ranking chiefs of the Wet'suwet'en Nation and of the Tsayu clan, as well as members of the Ginwinnan clan, have been fighting to protect their traditional territories against what they say is a destructive pipeline project, the Coastal GasLink pipeline. The conflict has erupted several times with violent arrests by the RCMP and even the permanent establishment of a community industry response group detachment 36 kilometers down a logging road south of Houston, BC. Now, several years into the conflict, the pipeline is nearing completion. However, many environmental, cultural, and social impacts have persisted, according to the Wet'suwet'en. In an attempt to speak to one of the main financiers of the multi-billion dollar and climbing project, the Royal Bank of Canada, Namox and a delegation of Wet'suwet'en members traveled to the RBC AGM in Saskatoon to speak directly to shareholders. What they faced was more harassment from police and security, as well as being barred from the proceedings. However, Namox still believes this pipeline will never see an ounce of gas. After the most recent environmental failure by CGL to protect critical salmon habitat, Namox worked with the United Nations Human Rights Forum to bring their struggle to the international stage. Here is the UN orator and Chief Namox of the Wet'suwet'en.
The Wet'suwet'en traditional territory was raided by the Coastal GasLink mercenaries, a branch of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, on behalf of Canada yesterday. Canada manufactures consent through statutory or puppet government institutions, despite that the 1997 Del Magook case recognizes traditional government authority. The Vatican is complicit in manipulated political partnerships emanating from the doctrine of discovery, committing crimes against humanity, and dispossession of indigenous territory. The treaty study of Professor Miguel Alfonso Martinez in paragraph 2221 describes coercion or aggression by armed force, judicial or legislation, as part of the history of Indigenous. This is a violation of Common Article 2 of the Geneva Conventions, where armed conflict is not necessary for an occupation. This is tantamount and is characterized as by denial of the right to self-determination based on doctrines of discovery, and apartheid legislation is a crime against humanity. We ask the Human Rights Council and its bodies to address the grave violation of rights based on legislation and violations of international law. Thank you.
Chief Namox of the Wet'suwet'en, along with a delegation of Wet'suwet'en members, traveled to Saskatoon for the RBC AGM earlier this year to plead their case and ask that the bank pull their funding from the Coastal GasLink pipeline. However, they were barred from proceedings, but managed to still speak with several investors. Here's my conversation with Chief Namox.
Well, we need to bring the fact to them that, you know, they are a major investor in pipelines and other oil and gas fossil fuel infrastructures to the tune of $262 billion, and $10.8 billion of that was involved in just the last year. And they need to understand what that money is doing, the destruction of lands, water, salmon, our security, our freedoms, and the very fact that they need to understand that they've got to be held accountable for what their money does. Somebody has to truly understand that it's more than just a dollar figure. It is everything that is attached to it. Whenever they say that, you know, we're going to use this 2050 timeline to make a difference, the difference should have been made decades ago, not 2050. They need to realize that. They have to understand what UNDRIP is, free, prior, and informed consent, which they haven't got from the hereditary chiefs on our territories to build a pipeline. And they need to know that the lack of humanity that is attached to their money has to be reinvested. They have to look at the moral consequences, not just the financial consequences.
I know that you guys have been gaining a lot of support over the last couple of years in dealing with this situation. Of course, a lot of the attention has been focused on RBC, even getting support from Hollywood, some support from Hollywood, which has an affiliate in the U.S. Holds a lot of celebrities' monies. But very little has moved on that, although that we've seen, you know, a lot of support coming, trying to get these banks to divest from these fossil fuel projects. It still seems like they're digging in. Is that kind of the message that you've been hearing from them as well and their shareholders? Or do you feel that some of their shareholders are concerned about this and might actually support your efforts?
Well, you're exactly right. We get support from around the world. Like when you talk of Hollywood and the musicians, directors, you know, we have the likes of like Mark Ruffalo, Meryl Streep, Leonardo DiCaprio, and they've all said the same thing, that the divestment of that money, they had no idea what their money is doing, because RBC owns Citibank, which is the bank they deal with, and they said we need to have better, and they're looking into having currently four smaller banks to move their money to, make them players, because they will invest in the future, and RBC is not. Like I said before, that 2050 timeline they have, and the greenwashing that they're using in their ads and communication that they have with their shareholders, that has to stop. The truth has to be told.
Now, Namox, are you planning on speaking at the AGM directly to those shareholders?
Absolutely. We have a contingent of about eight of us that are here. I'm going to support the motion put forward by Union of BC Indian Chiefs, as well as the BC GEU. And in that one, it was about upholding free, prior, and informed consent, acknowledging and implementing UNDRIP, and making sure that they have a plan for the future, making sure their messaging is clear and it can't be just financial statements. Let's look at the damage to the planet. Let's look at the damage to the human. They have to be aware of what's going on. They can't just look at numbers and say, this is what they're doing, and look at the bottom line. The bottom line is that money is killing this planet. That bottom line is that they're working on taking away the very democracy of this country, which is the voice of the people, and it can't be just steered by money. But a type of money that they control and loan out to support projects in the fossil fuel industry, there has to be consequences. Maybe the consequences is people walk away. You know, when we have people that are in support worldwide, let's make them understand that they understand money. Okay, well, this money has to talk, but talk in the right direction. And that's the future.
Now, Namox, I just want to shift, some of the attention for the moment. Obviously, there have been a number of situations, episodes that have unfolded over the last few years regarding the Ginnadan clan and the checkpoint camp village site that they have out at 44 and with workers of Coastal GasLink as well as their security force and the RCMP. Just the most recent episode was that the RCMP executed a search warrant and subsequently arrested five people at the 44 camp. This was all precipitated on a complaint that was filed by Coastal GasLink security that one of their workers was swarmed by a group of individuals who you know, for lack of a better word, from the RCMP attacked this worker with flares and stole some equipment. That ended up causing a search warrant and these subsequent arrests. You know, what do you have to say for some of that activity? What do you think is going on out there? Could you give us an update as to what happened and again, what is the situation unfolding and what comes next with the 44 camp as some of these incidents seem to be continuing as construction carries on?
Well, the very fact that this is the first time they've used a search warrant, then they state Crown land. It's not Crown land. We've never signed a treaty. We're unceded, and we've never, ever even planned on signing a treaty. So it's land in dispute. It is still under control of the Wet'suwet'en Hereditary Chief on behalf of our houses and clans. You know, when CGL signs agreements with reserves, reserves only have authority within the boundaries of the reserve, just like a municipality. The territory belongs to the houses and clans, and all the clans have stated no pipeline on the territory. Now, when they come in there and they say they have a search warrant, they were looking for a power saw, mask, and camo gear. I don't know. I've never seen CGL wear camo gear, and we have enough power saws. We don't need to be taking anybody's power saws. So it was just their way of more intimidation, their way of extending their violence upon our people. And they had arrested five because all the people out there, all we asked was, we want 15 minutes to read the search warrant. We want to talk to our legal representatives. They said, absolutely not. They punched one of the fellas in the face and put him face first on the ice, handcuffed him, one of our ladies. They put zip straps on her for simply wanting a witness. They weren't violent in any way. They say, we want to make sure that you're not going to plant evidence on us because we know we didn't do it, but we want to monitor what you're doing. It's pretty much the same idea that they use with DFO, tell them that we are violent people and we should stay away for their own safety. That way DFO doesn't monitor out there. So the narrative they got is not the truth, really. We are the chiefs. We told them we'll always remain peaceful. The violence comes at us in so many forms. Like I said, this is the first time they used a search warrant. And yet, in a matter of months, we did hundreds of visits and walks through our village sites there, saying it's a safety concern, up to 8 and 10 times a day, middle of the night, all day long. But this is the first time they came up with saying, oh, we're going to look for a power saw and camo gear. I'm like, why on earth would you do that? And then not even allow our people to witness what they're doing, because we don't trust them. We know they tamper with evidence. We know they plant evidence. So now that narrative of, we're there and we're violent. I think it's because they don't want to admit that their drill under Wet'suwet'en is stuck. It hasn't moved for a month. That's going to quadruple the cost of that project right there. So they're just deflecting on the truth. And we thought, well, you know what? We need to be at the RBC AGM and tell the people what that money is funding, why CERB is such in dire straits that they have to go and be so violent. We're also working to have CERB disbanded. You can't have an arm of the RCMP created in 2017 simply to allow industry to till waters, rivers, the air, add to greenhouse gas emissions, allow to enhance climate damage throughout the planet. So this is what we're doing, and we'll do it peacefully all the way through, no matter what narrative the government of Canada, British Columbia, CGL, Forestry Security, or the RCMP put out there.
You know, it seems like this is not the first time that the RCMP have raided that camp before. As you mentioned, this is the first time they've actually had
documentation, a warrant, a search warrant. You know, but how, what do you make of them claiming that there was a security, a Coastal GasLink security officer that was swarmed by, in their words, a group of individuals wearing masks and camouflage at the 43-kilometer mark? What do you make of that? If that's what the RCMP are putting out there?
I'd like to have their definition of swarming. You know, a couple of people go in there. Of course, they're going to be insulted and put insults back, but we would never condone violence. You have to think about last July. We had 30 people going out there to raft the river, to feel how it is to drink out of the river, and yet they put out the narrative that there were 30 protesters and that they had to call in serve, and yet they were government representatives. You know, they were guests on the territory to enjoy the territory. But unfortunately, they got caught up in all of this, and they were labeled violent protesters. Like, how dare they put out that narrative?
Now, Namox, again, you know, the other day there was a situation that unfolded at the UN in Geneva, the forum, the permanent forum on the rights of indigenous people. Tell me a little bit about how that came to be following this incident out at 44 with the arrests of five people. How did that all come to be, and what was said? What was the message that was sent to the UN? What was that?
Well, that transpired because an ambassador from Alaska contacted me and wanted an update. And he said, you know, I got an opportunity to bring it to the UN, should I? I said, absolutely. The world has to know what's happening up here. So him and I worked on a statement just previous to him presenting it. And it just so happened to be the very same day that the doctrine of discovery was repudiated. So all tied together perfectly. But getting the truth out to the world is what has to be done. I've spoken there three times previously, twice in New York, once in Geneva. They are well aware of what is happening in Canada. They are well aware that the abuses of human and indigenous rights are happening. And it has to be remembered, the UN has actually sent Canada three letters in regards to that, and Canada has not responded once.
Namox, maybe you can tell me what comes next after this.
Well, the very fact that we've never agreed to this from day one, there was not any free, prior, and informed consent, and the damage that they're doing to the Northwest. You've got to realize our rivers flow to the Skeena as well as the Fraser. So we have a huge responsibility to our neighbors downstream as well as downwind. The wind blows and water flows. We're not talking about just one small area. We're talking about British Columbia, which affects Canada, which affects the world. And our next step is to continue to ever allow them to have this here catastrophic pipeline built in our territory, because it just adds to it. And you said Kitimat LNG, you know, that $40 billion project, you know, they keep saying it's in the highest private investment in the history of Canada. But why should Canada be investing in killing the climate on this entire project? One of the worst polluters would be that if it was ever finished. Let's talk about the hydro. Where are they going to get the hydro from? They aren't going to have the hydro. So we got to look again at the damages to the Northwest, to the rivers, to everything that we rely on. It is simply, to them, just a footnote in their reports. And yet this is our life. This is our home. This is our future. This is for our children. They are not looking at that. They need to realize that. And we are going to bring that message to them.
All right, Namox, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks so much for your time. Of course, as always, I'm obliged to you for answering my questions.
And thank you for listening, because people have to know the damage. We know the damage because we've seen it elsewhere. We really want our waters poisoned. We really want our grandchildren not to know what freedoms are. That is what we're doing.
You've been listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook at CICK News. CICK News is made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to our producer Pam Hassan and all of our roving reporters, I'm Dan Messick. Thanks for listening.